I've always been one of these people that felt that the Christian community had violated our people so violently and so drastically that many of our brothers and sisters will not even come into a Christian church in this day. To those of you that don't know, most of our tribal groups had religions existing in the tribal groups prior to the coming of Caucasian settlers into the United States. And it was also forecast by many of the tribal groups that there would be other people coming to this great land, that it was indeed God's gift to humanity, and that we must all share in it, and we must all realize that God's gift is us, our lives, how we live it, loving one another. And the apology basically has come out and said that. And so John had a great hand in presenting it. John is one of the people that I honestly would miss if he decided to move elsewhere. I mean, I have free access to all of Western Washington from where I work.
We want him back in Oregon, so he can move back there.
So when I have a problem or when I want some response from someone or see how things are going in Indian country,
yes,
it's amazing. I call John. So at this point, I will call on John Magnuson, my friend, to present his explanation of our letter of apology. I'm sure if those of you that have not seen it, it's in your packets. Take it with you. Share it with anyone that would listen, because it speaks a lot to all of us. No further comments. John, the floor is yours.
Durant Hotel, off Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, 1981 January. I went down to PLTS, a seminary there for a cross-cultural ministry. I really had very little experience here in the Pacific Northwest and in the western part of the country with any kind of native groups or Indian communities. That night in January, I had a dream. And the dream was that I was in a circle like this of native people. And a voice came out of the darkness. And the voice said, "Don't talk." The next morning, I went to the conference. It was a small group about this size. And it was primarily native people from around the United States. Some of you were there at that conference. And, I really had no agenda when I went down to Berkeley except just to hang out a little bit. So I decided to try and experiment and follow the dream, which for a pastor is kind of tough, especially when the words are "don't talk." So that day, I practiced the dream. I mean, I honored the dream and did not say a word. On the plane trip back to Seattle, Marilyn Bodie was sitting next to me, and she leaned over and she said, "You know, they were watching you, Magnuson." And I said, "What do you mean watching me?" Well, she said, "There's a political thing going on within the National Indian Lutheran Board," which was our extension of ministry, and many of you knew Gene Crawford, who spearheaded that organization for 16 years. "They were watching you," she said. They had one vacancy. There were 9 natives and 3 non-natives on this commission, and they had a vacancy, but they wanted a white person who could keep their mouth shut. The next day, Ramona called me. This is serious. The next day, Ramona called me and she said, "You know, I've been talking with some folks, and we'd like to invite you to serve in that capacity." So, well, the point of the story is last night I went to sleep and waited for a dream. And unfortunately for you, I did not get one that said, don't talk. I'm here to talk unapologetically for just a few minutes about the apology. I'd like to begin by saying I really am standing here today in the presence of a lot of my teachers and my guides, and they need to be honored. And last night when we were singing, I had a tear in my eye because I looked around the room and several of you have been very, very important for my own journey, and I want to say that to you. And I'm just going to name a few of you now, but I want to honor that. Certainly my godmother in Indian country, Ramona, and the tremendous doors and good wisdom and warnings you have given me, and most of all, your sense of humor, which is always put me in the appropriate place. And she knows how to laugh at me more than anyone that I really know, and appreciate that. Also Helen Peterson, who first time I met Helen was at the BIA office across the street at the cafeteria, and I was running cigarettes for her. She had me running cigarettes for her. And I was planning a trip across Indian country with my son, and she picked up the phone. We went back to the office, and for the next hour and a half, she was on the phone. We called Wind River, Pine Ridge, Klamath. I mean, my journey back to the Midwest, I had open doors, whatever reservation I went into, because Helen sent me. And that was just a wonderful tribute to that credibility and trust that Helen carries across Indian country. Mark, my guide into the Shaker community, tremendous gifts you bring to our church community in Seattle, Mark, and I honor you for that. Also, Ted George. All I can say to you is if you ever get a chance to go to he and Carlene's place on the Kitsap Peninsula, on Suquamish, and eat some clams and smoked salmon. It's a tremendous, wonderful honor. And Ted, for your wisdom and guidance also, my tribute to you. And lastly, very just quickly, my co-chair of the Task Force Maryland Laundry, again, a sister in our work. And also Paul Bartling and Lud Siglin. Where is Lud? Is Lud here?
Right here.
Lud. These two guys are really important, I believe, for the future of our work together. They represent, along with Gordy, the gatekeepers, the guides through the maze of the church bureaucracy. They're the ones who can talk to us about timing and about accountability and about the paper trail that you have to leave if you're going to survive working in the white world, because that's how the system works, through paper. And these guys know what that's about and how important that is in order to make things happen in defense and in protection of Native communities and Native rights. So I'm surrounded and I'm already feeling more comfortable. Let me also say a couple things in preface to the inside story very briefly on the apology. I'd like to say something about the different worlds that have come together here for the weekend. Reuben and I gave a talk, remember, up at Magnolia Presbyterian Church about a year ago. We were speaking to a women's group, and I said, Reuben, what should we call this? Because we're just going to tell our story, as Joanne always says, it's the only thing we really have to say is our story to tell. And he said, let's call it Two Worlds, John. And that's what I'd like to talk just real briefly about in terms of the apology, the two worlds. At the end of the presentation, one of the women, we were eating lunch, she came up to Reuben. She said, Reuben, this has really been fascinating. Are there any Indians left living around Seattle? It's a quote from a gal in Magnolia, showing again the separation of the worlds, huh, that exists in much of the dominant culture. People don't know Native people are out there, and when they finally meet one, if you're not dressed the right way or look the right way, they walk away disappointed.
That's right.
What we call racism. Mm-hmm. Two worlds. And I want to say just something briefly about it. There's a political world here this weekend. And there's a spiritual world here this weekend. And they're going to bump up against each other. They're going to bump up. There's going to be a little tension. There's a Native world here. And there's a non-Native. Now, I'm going to call it a white world, but I say it a white world because it's dominated by Western values. And those worlds also collide here. See, there are different rules, right? You all know that there's different etiquette when you move across. Now, what I'm going to try to do in the next few minutes, and what I think we're trying to do this weekend, is to move between these worlds. Move across. Wendell Berry, some of you know, has a wonderful poem about resurrection. He says, "Be like a coyote. Make more tracks than are necessary. Some in the wrong direction." So, when I'm crossing over here in the next few minutes, you're going to be wondering, hey, where is he going? He was just talking about politics. Now he's talking about spiritual things. Well, I'm a coyote here, so you can do the best you can with the tracks that I'm going to try to leave. The apology. Ted, I want you and Carleen to come and sit right here by me. I need you to sit by me. And I want to honor you here. Ted and Carleen were with us in downtown Seattle. I need you with me. Thanks. February, I'm going to try to make this as brief as I can and then just end with a few reflections. And perhaps Ted and Joanne and others then can respond. I think that's part of the agenda very briefly. February 1987, a letter comes from a Lummi Indian to the Church Council of Greater Seattle. Very interesting letter. It says, "The churches here in the Northwest have really been with us since the Bolt decision days, advocating for treaty rights and standing in solidarity with Native people. But there's been one area, one thing you have never spoken to, and it is a deep wound in our people's hearts. And that is the destruction of our deepest spiritual teachings and practices. Why have you not said anything? Or do you have anything to say?" That letter came to a man by the name of Bill Cape. And Cape made a decision. And this is for Lud and Paul, who need to help us always make these kinds of decisions. Cape said, "You know, if the Ecumenical Church Council wrote a response to this letter, or if the Native American Task Force wrote a response to this letter, nobody would read the thing. Because the real power in the church lies, like it does in Indian country, with tribal groups and gatherings and coalitions." And he said, "We need to consider taking this letter, and we'll be the servants of the denominational leaders, but if we could access the bishops and the denominational executives, then If they made a decision to make a response, we would help architect that. That is where the power is, because they will speak to their people. That was a political decision that was made, a decision of discernment. Decisions that Lud and Paul have to make all the time, and Gordy have to make all the time, about how you play the single card that you have. Ted, you also enforce your position all the time. So, Harold Culbertson, Fort Peck Sioux, some of you know, consultation, a consultant for Northwest Tribes. He was our front man and went to the bishops and for part of a day talked about Indian country and explained and presented the letter. The bishop said, if you guys write a draft, we might have time to look at it. That was what we needed. Harold came back, and then we, as a task force, talked about how would we write such a thing, a ghost, you know, ghost write such a expression. And I had been hanging around enough with you guys to know that you have to have the right time to do something like that, and you have to find the right place. And that didn't happen until October. And it happened at the Taos Pueblo, the ceremonial grounds. And a member of the task force wrote the initial draft. And then for the next few weeks, it was brought back, revised, and brought to the bishops. And in a series of meetings, that was brokered. And I have that is a story that I would not want to be made entirely public. If anybody would know it, there was a lot of humor in it. Believe me, a lot of confrontation between the bishops. Murphy, Archbishop Murphy, Ralph, where are you? And Joanne, he said, I'm calling Tekakwitha before I'm saying another word. And when they get back to me, then we'll talk. That was from the Catholic side. The Episcopal side said, don't quote me, Helen, I'm going to have to live with this. He said, I am so sick of apologizing to gays and women's and black, and now the Indians want me to say we're sorry. I got nothing to say, I've got nothing to say we're sorry for. That was his response. And in some of the final wording, one of the bishops said, you change it, this was a confrontation across the table. You change another word on this, this was one bishop to another denominational letter, and I'm walking. That's how tight it got. But somehow the spirit worked in among that conversation, those tensions. The spirit worked. And the decision came to sign, and the next problem was how to make the presentation. And so there was a decision that one of the ancient burial sites in Seattle that is on the corner of First and Spring Streets, now covered up with concrete, busy intersection will be chosen. And representatives we invited from the 26 federally recognized tribes of Oregon.
Washington.
Washington, sorry. And we asked that no media be present except one person from the Seattle Times. And this apology was read and presented to the Indian people. And Ted and Carlene were there to bear witness to them. One of the last decisions with the bishops was, and I had also learned, of course, this from Indian country, when you make a commitment, there needs to be a sign of good faith. And Bill Cade and the task force suggested that we make a monetary gift going along with the apology from the 9 denominations representing 1,800 parishes. So we called Ramona and said, Ramona, what do you think? And Ramona said, call NARF. and designate a monetary gift from the denominational executives to be used to defend the protection of Native spiritual practices in the courts in the Northwest. So we went into the last meeting, and Bill and I had talked with some of the members of the task force. We thought, what would be appropriate gift? And we thought, well, you know, since this is such a momentous statement, we felt perhaps $1,000 or something for each of the denominations. We went in, and they said, well, how much kind of a gift are you talking about? I remember the conversation. And one of the bishop's denominational executives said, well, how much? What are you thinking about? And we said, about $1,000. And before we could finish the statement, the sentence, one of the bishops said, well, that's $100 a piece. I suppose we could do that. And I looked at Kate, and Kate went, and I went, that'll be fine. That money, then, gift, along with the apology, was sent to NARF, and that's how we met Steve Moore.
Yeah.
And that's why he's here today with us. Now, it got, a thing happened here, and now I'm going to move the coyote, so you follow me, if you can, huh? Something happened that nobody believed was there. There was another world that opened up. Do you remember the resurrection story of Thomas, these days of Easter? Jesus says, you don't believe, huh? You touch my wounds. You put your hand in my side. You touch the holes in my hand. That's what happened. Nobody believed the deep pain that Native people carried, unspoken, about this problem. And that night, a Lummi drove in a pickup truck into British Columbia and read the apology to 3,000 Crees that were gathered in the smokehouse ceremony. That night, 22nd of November, the witness that came to me said, there was weeping in the smokehouse because of that apology being read. I will simply say that it moved, and the apology has moved. It hangs in Geneva, Switzerland. It's been translated in Central America to tribes in the Amazon there. I want to simply say that one of the jobs of the task force and the churches is to hold the church to its promises, much like Gordy and many of you are involved in terms of holding the ELCA to their commitments. To do that, you need a budget, you need some money, you need some resources. And since the apology was given to the tribes, there have been four actions that have happened, and I'm going to simply wind this down by honoring those actions. The first thing that we needed, first of all, the phone started to ring off the hook from tribes and different groups. A lot of them coming in wanting the bishops to own up to what they said, but also Native people coming in to access money. And some of the claims were not legitimate. One was, I won't name the tribe, Eastern Washington, needed a commitment of the bishops to do a media piece and claimed his credentials as being in one of the secret societies, Nez Perce. Ted said, warned us. Let me make a few phone calls. He called the tribal council, spiritual leaders. Nobody ever heard of this guy. So I went, and several of us, a couple of us, went to the bishops and said, hey, if you want to hold your promises, you're going to need a screening agency. And you've got to drop this denominational stuff that you're all worried about, your territorialism. You've got to come together here and work together And so in order to do that, we need a part-time, small part-time office. We're not building a little kingdom. We just need enough for stamps and somebody to answer the phone. That's why Adams is sitting here today. And he came to our task force. That's why he came. He came to our task force, not to an ad in the paper. That's another spiritual story, how he came. But he is here today, and I want to honor him. Now, we screened then the requests that came to act in the apology, and there've been four specific actions that we've chosen to go to the bishops with to act on. Well, first was seven elk skins worth about $800 to repair 9 ceremonial drums in the state of Washington that were used in religious services in the prisons. And one of the bishops came and presented 9 or 8 elk skins from Bellingham to the spiritual leader that's working in the prisons in the state of Washington, Bob Schimmick. The second action, along with the NARF gift, was a struggle for a burial site in San Juan Islands called Madrona Point. In Life magazine, you can read that story in May. I have not yet read the article, but there's an article on Madrona Point quoting G.I. James, several of the Lummi tribal leaders, in their struggle to save that burial site. The churches are not mentioned, by the way, for an interesting reason. But that's another story. I want to say that our work in Indian country, I think, I'm speaking to the church leaders here especially, we got to quit worrying who's going to get the credit, you know? We gotta drop that and get out of the way. We're servants. That's the call, it seems to me. And I think when we do our negotiations here for the next day here, I hope we can kind of get out of the way and let the Spirit move and come and move through us. Because there are some tremendous things about to be born. We believe, several of us, and Steve hinted at that himself last night, between a partnership of the churches and Indian people across the country. Lastly, the peyote case, we went back to honor, in light of the apology, we flew one of the bishops and Bill Cate to the Supreme Court. NARF picked up the airfare. But you need to know the bishops and the denominational leaders, they're no fools. They don't get used. And if they feel they're getting used, you'll know it. So what they want is credibility. And what they want is people that do their homework. And what they want is to make sure that they don't look like fools because they don't know what's going on when they go up against attorneys and others. And so part of our work has been to be that go-between group. I guess I'll close by a story from Mother Teresa. And I don't know if it's true, but the story says that she went to her superiors about 50 years ago and said, "I have 3 pennies and a dream. And I want to build an orphanage." And her superior said, "Sister Teresa, you can't build an orphanage with 3 pennies. You can't build anything with 3 pennies." And the legend has it, the story has it, that Sister Teresa looked her straight in the eye and said to her superior, "With 3 pennies and with God, I can build anything." I guess what I want to leave you with here is if there is not a vision, and I believe ultimately a spiritual one, that will call us into partnership and give birth to a new awakening of the spiritual world, that no matter what the budget is for the ELCA, you know, the vision for Native work or anything else, we will die. Perhaps as a culture, and perhaps many of you in terms of just your own survival as Indian people, as a community. So I guess one of the reasons I've come here is to pray for that vision, that it will be somehow this weekend, with our expert guides through the maze here, Helen, others, and Ted, can give birth, huh, to that life-giving spiritual world, which Ira and I spent an hour talking about last night, in which Joanne taught me to pray about. So thank you, and it's an honor again to be here.
Now for the response, I'm going to ask several of you to respond to what John has said and a little bit of your own feelings about the apology, because the apology is really an interesting document. I'm going to ask Ted to talk a little bit about tribal governments in the Pacific Northwest. We have 41 tribal governments that belong to what is called the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Southeast Alaska, Northern California tribes. And they came together because the apology needed to go someplace. It needed to be accepted by somebody in power within Indian country. Otherwise, it's out there. And so, Ted, I want you to share a little bit about that process. And then, Ray, I'd like to have, you know, some of your perspectives, and then any other person around the circle that has heard of somebody or something who has heard about the apology and what it has or has not done. Okay, Ted?
Thank you. I want to preface my remarks by how I became involved. I think it's kind of an incredible, it's more than coincidence. I, in my work throughout the West, tribes and urbans and whatever, you know, broad mix of people that I worked with. And I kept hearing about the Church Council of Greater Seattle and the things that they were doing, the things that they were standing for. And I knew that they were also cautioning politicians who make a lot of hay out of what they will do if you elect me. You know, we've got to have equality. We can't have these superior rights. And of course, that's the fodder that they use to get themselves elected. The Church Council was making it very clear to them that that was not the kind of posturing that was acceptable. And then, as I heard smatterings of this, in my work, and I think my friends in our lives, it's incumbent on all of us to search for those that have that uniqueness and gift and are willing to follow those kinds of unique things that allow them to be the kind of change agents, you know, the selfless types, and there are a lot of them in this world. So I said, now who are these guys? So I knew how a few of the people that were involved and called up and said, if you don't mind, I'd like to sit in with you. I want to meet some of you. I want to know who you are. Because I'm networking, none of us will ever know the total answers to things. but by establishing the kind of collective networks that we need, we're more effective. We're helping others be more effective. We cross-connect so that others can really get the benefit of the intelligence and the will and the energy and the bonding that we all need as Christians and as Indian people. So I wander in. I sort of described it once in John's class. It was sort of like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids, that they were being chased. They said, "Who are those guys? They're good." And what I felt about them as I went in there, I didn't know who they were, but I just knew that they represented some good energy. So I go in, and they are reading the final document. I come in on a Wednesday, I meet with them. And on a Saturday, they're going to present that document down on the First Avenue in Seattle. And I read it and was impressed. It was you must read it and reread it. Because it's one of those things that, you know, it really does re-energize you and recommit you to what you're all about. And knowing that there are others, you know, it's almost, in our lives, it's almost been Indians against the rest. We can't even align too well with one another. Small tribes, large tribes, Northwest, the Plains folks, you know, we have problems doing our collective will. So I go home and tell Carlene about it and share the document with her. And we get up Saturday morning, and that's our quiet time. We reflect on all of the things that we really have about an hour or so where we do a lot of deliberating on things that will help us. And we, you know, we really help one another out. Really, we get into some very insightful things. It's kind of our, we reserve that time just to do that. And she said to me, "Ted, I think we ought to go over to Seattle today and witness." And that kind of got me. The word witness, we all, you know, that we witness things, and we had witnesses who would recall, to retain, and remember intact those critical things. So I kind of, well, I don't know, she kept harping, not harping, she didn't really harp with that. Brought a very compelling argument. So we get up and we catch the ferry. And we go and we walk up the street there, and I miss it by a street. And she's the descendant of the Clark family, you know, the ones that came across, and she's always reminded me of that. And we participate and we witness what's happening that day. The declaration and the response by the Lummis to the declaration. The bishop happens to be an Episcopalian who has some Native American blood. And the audible gasp by some of the Yakimas as that is acknowledged. And there are a few events in my life that I have to recall with such emotion that that's one. I have here the principal author of that document. He had the insight, the sensitivity to describe that, to present it, to refine it. The architect of that thing is right here. And he won't take the credit. The credit of that document, and that, in my friends, I view that document as probably one of the singular documents that I have ever read. I also view it as representing the opportunity for Indian people to connect with the Christian community who is now standing and saying and speaking and advocating and is on the mat with us, for us. That's a given. They're there. And as a piddling half of 1% of the total population, I saw the energy that an institution, the churches represent, and what that can do as we began looking at curing societal and other kinds of ills it represents some healing and the asking of the forgiveness, the way Christianity ought to work. It worked. And we now have this bonding. We will never, ever be the same again. And I urge you, don't forget, the author is here. And he is the one that has helped bring the different positioning, the different statements that came from the different people that sit on that task force, and the very delicate balancing act that that document has to accomplish, because the political part of that, in both from the Indian, you know, the Indians come and want certain things, well, you've said this now, you know, and how do we really establish the kind of delicate trust, the delicate balancing that has to go off among the forces that affect that particular document. John does that well. And I just commend Ron for the marvelous work that he's done and trying to glue. He's a lot of the glue. John is kind of the dust devil, as you plains folks might talk about. He is doing the right thing, but just trying to find what's the residue. not too apt, John. I'll recoup that one a little bit. But as a result of that document, then, this document was presented to the affiliated tribes, and Ramona kind of farmed this out to me. She was the executive director of that group and knows much more about this than I do, but I think wanted me just to make you aware that there was a formal response from 40-some members of the affiliated tribe expressing that they asked the church council to work with their groups to get them to accept this. And reflect their official sentiments and intent. Also, they indicated, and this is where I think, too, this document also needs to walk. It asks that we begin looking at our national church leadership and try and see if a national document might emerge. Their response also said that we will work with you as we begin to educate the churches on each other. So there's that commitment. And John and Ron draw on people, the Rubens and the others, the Marylands and Marks and others within that church council to help us all make that happen. And as a result of that document, the demands on any people to talk about it and this understanding, I think that has came about because of this document, is probably one of the real significant events of this generation and our lifetimes. The church is an institution, I think, you know, that's when we get something that has the institutional memory. Not just because there were marvelous people with marvelous thoughts, with marvelous documents that were there at that time in that station, doesn't necessarily mean that the intent and spirit of that is going to be conveyed from that point on, unless we have the means to do that. So we are still trying to, I think, working at institutionalizing and expanding that document. I think, too, that we Indian people are blessed, doubly blessed, because not only do we have some of the insights and the wisdoms of our traditional Indian beliefs and practices, but now we have the chance to see how the Christian principles, doctrines, their application and the similarities. They are so close that you can't hardly differentiate very little of what are, you know, when we put things to the very, we factor them down to the very basic things, the Christianity theme and the Native American traditional experience and expression are practically one. So I think those kind of are the statements that I wanted to make on behalf of that document. And I just really feel that we as people and Christians can create that kind of oneness, that kind of love, that unconditional love that we have to feel. And the Lutheran people, by allowing us to come here, you know, we've got to try and create the atmosphere that permits that kind of dialogue so we know one another. To know them is to love them. And I think this is an opportunity that has been afforded us. So I thank you for the chance to offer just a few of my thoughts today and to this group. And there's a lot of other beautiful people that I want to get to know, because I'm constantly expanding that network. I have still have some hopes and aspirations before I head to that big reservation of the sky. Accomplishing a few more. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. And do I understand that you are now the chairman of the club?
I have been for 20 years.
You have been? I must get you and Ron mixed up. Ron Allen.
There are three groups of clowns, and I'm the general chairman of all of them.
Are you really? See, I never knew that. Isn't that just amazing?
Really.
Another thing that I've been on. That isn't amazing at all. Ray?
That was amazing. My name, for some of you who don't know, is Ray Williams. I'm of the Swinomish tribe up in the San Juan Islands in Northwest Washington. There's a few other gentlemen that were scheduled to be here from our tribe. Bob Joe Sr., who is the chairman of our tribe and is the up-and-coming, moving up to the, hopefully, one day, deacon of our church. One day, and Father Pat Tuohy, I see his book there on the altar, who has been a real inspiration to our people and to try to blend, to make our people feel comfortable in the Christian Roman Catholic Church. And they've been very outspoken on Indian issues, on Indian involvement in the church and on Indian involvement in a lot of other areas. And so, it is to them that I am most likely here. I just admire Ted and so many others in this room that it's just a pleasure to be around the circle of people who are considering and kicking around ideas that are dealing with the future of our people and with those young ones up there on the second level who will one day be taking these responsible roles. If we can work on these in a real human, I like to look at human manner, and not trying to find out who's going to be the power brokers and who's going to be the most influential, but rather identifying those real qualities of gifts that we have inside ourselves and sharing those with all those who enter the circle, as our elders and our ancestors would have wanted us to, that then we'll be on the right track to hopefully being able to do the apology. And with these doors that are seem to be opening in other arenas as well, outside of the religious sphere, in the economic and all other aspects of our life, it seems like people, whether they be friends or foe, are wanting to listen to what we have to say. And so, like some people say, we have to do our homework. We have to. I was at a conference in January, and a gentleman said, this born-again Christian movement is something real powerful, and that we're experiencing in Indian country, whether we identify it or not, a born-again Indian movement, where we're finally identifying and realizing that there's so much beauty and so much value to the history of our people and the culture and the traditions, and that we have to familiarize ourselves with those and to become representatives of our people, to be up there and to do our homework and to be those models and to not look for the honor, but rather the service of our people. I feel personally that the things that are said in this statement here, that it's not really the church's responsibility to fulfill those obligations. It's us as individuals working with the church to fulfill those responsibilities. It becomes a responsibility of humanity, of us all working together in order to achieve something that's going to be so powerful and so precious that we all can gain from it and benefit from each other's worlds, whether it be the technical or whether it be the cultural or whether it be the whatever we want to look at. I see the two worlds. I remember one person saying, speaking of the third world and saying that we were a part of that, the Indian population was a part of that. And I think it's time for us to stop separating ourselves into all these different worlds and start talking and looking at each other as prospective friends and neighbors and dealing with that respect and honor that our elders had offered to us and that our ancestors had left as models for us to deal with. The majority of the gifts and the development that are going to take place in Indian country are going to take place because of Indian leaders and because of Indian influence and Indian visions that are going to create that real solidification and that bonding and that empowerment, that self-esteem is going to come from within the people. That there aren't going to be any magical potions that are going to be offered to our people or any consultants that are going to come in and tell us what's right or wrong about our people. The people are going to have to identify, recognize, and figure out how to work their way through it. I feel that these apologies and all these other things that come down in black and white, that a lot of our people in Indian country are leery of it. They've seen treaties walked on, they've seen promises thrown out the window, they've seen the churches step and on and insult our culture and our traditions and our teachings, and they're very hesitant to be wanting to look at something like this and to accept it as an open gesture of approval and acceptance. And so we, the people who are willing to take that first step, need to go out there and to work with our own people and to talk to them and not try to force it on them, but let them know that there is hope and that the real value of anything that's going to happen is going to come from them, and that we are only there to assist them along the way. I and several others have been getting together and we decided to call this group One with Creation. And the philosophy behind it, it's Indians and non-Indians getting together and working on identified problem areas in Indian country, basically. A person asked me to summarize what we planned on doing, and the way that I looked at it as in the Northwest, with the salmon being a real staple in the culture of our people, a real sacred and a very special gift to our people, to watch the salmon and to understand its life. In the spawning grounds, when the fingerling, where it starts developing, from the egg, it's in a real calm area. There's not a lot of current or anything going on, and it's a real protective environment, basically. And as the fingerling grows in confidence and in strength, it goes out to a little deeper channel, and there's a little more of a current, and so it builds his strength slowly, and he builds his confidence until the point where he goes out even deeper into the channels. and even more the current, and he builds up that energy and that strength and the confidence to that one point where he can turn around and walk and swim out to the greater oceans, to the greater river and the greater ocean, and to live out his life. One with creation wants to use that very same philosophy of, we have a lot of people in Indian country who are not empowered at the present time, who don't have that self-esteem or that confidence or that visionary message that they can rely on. And so we want to put together a team of people who are interested and willing to spend the time with those very same individuals in community, the grassroots people, and to assist them until they can go on their own. And for us to be satisfied with just being there and watching it all develop and to take place. I have a feeling that that's something that the task force is really all about too, is to connect people together, to have those visionary people and the grassroots people and all the peoples of interest to come together and to do things in that very same context. Our organization, One Creation, has no money. We have a lot of people on board that are willing to dedicate a portion of their time to something to serve others. And I think the key to a lot of what Indian country is all about is that there doesn't have to be a real gigantic sum of money for miracles to take place. There doesn't have to be a lot of experts on board in order for us to design a way to get through a crisis. And so with that, I again say to you all that our journey is going to be a struggle at times. It's going to be a blessing to us all. And I pray that we all can get stronger throughout this journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. And then I would like each of you now to feel free to express, you know, some of the other things that maybe you have heard about or you have experience with regarding the apology. And I know that there's several in the circle that do.
I don't know, listening to both Stephen and John, I thought how strange it was that during this time in history that religious doors are opening or bishops are joining together to apologize for the destruction, but legal powers are joining together to destroy those same things that this apology apologizes for. And it made me think that, I don't know, a month ago or so, Ruben brought home all the things that Ron gave him from Adrenal Point. And so I didn't have anything to do one night, and I read every article that John wrote and every newspaper article, and I read just every single thing that had been written about the Adrenal Point. And I thought, how weird, you know, that a few scraggly Indians and, you know, few religious guys, probably you look at them, you didn't think they had any power, actually unseated, you know, tremendous wealth, tremendous power, and that only thing was collective moral pressure and power, and that probably in this room, each one of us touches, you know, 5 people or 20 people, 100 people, but each one of us has that power to collectively overturn those things that will be on the legal books for 150 years. And there's been times when a lot of wrong was done, I mean, to the Jews. But there were people who took the Jews in, or there were people who wore the mark of Judaism to unseat the laws. So, and I think because there are so few Indians, it has to be a collective moral power of both white people who support the apology's meaning, and Indians who, you know, go forward from what spiritual bases are given them to unseat those laws.
Vincente?
I go back on Helen Peterson many years ago, and she's like a religious revolutionary to me. And she helped me years back, so it's really been a pleasure of getting back associated with her. But she's used religious offices, religious persons, to bring about equity, to bring about some change. And I think that religious organizations have to put themselves on the altar and say, use this because that's what we were supposed to be for. And it seems to me that that's kind of happening, but it has to be a real blatant thing of using the religious offices, I think, kind of like forcing the concept over and over and over again as everybody was created equal. And Catholic Clueless said that many, many times. And so our offices, our positions, our money, our everything are at your disposal. Until it comes to that basic thing, I think there's going to be some problems.
I took time to make it up to put on a point for the acquisition ceremony. And I was up there with the friend Glenn Phillips, and it was a very great and rewarding experience to be able to make it up and be part of the acquisition ceremony at the Drummond Point. It's one time that we have been able to, I think, what the apology is really trying to say to us. It will be working, and I think we have to continue to say that it will be working.
I would like to share something from the Loving community. They have an RCIA program there, and it's grown to be quite a large group, and they have a lot of elders in there. And at the time that they were discussing the apology, the men started crying, and one of them said, "Now we have to forgive them." And to me, that is the key, that's the turning point, because as long as we carry around that hate and unforgiveness of what was done to us, we will not be a happy people, we will not be a proud people. So for an elder to say that in a large group, say, "Now we have to forgive them," that's the turning point. Now there's hope in Indian country, because we are starting to learn to forgive and bygones be bygones. And that gives me a lot of hope. A lot of hope for you.
Well, you all have copies of that in your packets. And like you said, I think first things first, you know, when you apologize to someone, usually the thing of it is that other person has to accept it and say, "I accept your apology." I think that's one of the things that we in Indian country have to do. And in doing so, we also must say, you know, like you said, "We accept your apology. And for the wrongs we have done to you, accept our apology. Let's work together." It's important that this be done, primarily because, you know, within family squabbles, that there's no apology. There's a lot of problems that come up, a lot of things that continue. We are one family. You know, someone asked me a while ago, "Was I a relative of so-and-so Frank?" My answer to everyone, you know, if they ask me if I'm related to someone, it's always, "Yes, I'm related to them through the blood of Adam and Eve, because God created us all in one blood." And I think it's important that, you know, we recognize the Johns, the Rons, the Luds, whoever is out there working in God's world, to realize that not only do we get the support from them, but they get the support from us. We must speak to them and say, "Good job. I appreciate what you're doing. Because like I said, after all, we are all God's people, and we have to realize that. True, there are a lot of other people out there that want nothing to do with the Christian religion, which is quite understandable. I could tell you stories of my coming up. I grew up in a Presbyterian church, and I knew that, you know, my grandmother always talked about this loving God that was in the church. All I ever heard was hellfire and damnation about us pagan Indians that, you know, didn't realize or didn't know about it. However, I knew that God from living with my grandmother. And that God was always a loving God. Yet when I would go to church, I didn't see that. And so I left the church. Plain and simply told that Presbyterian minister, I said, I will never cross that doorway of your church as long as that loving God turns to be a spiteful God that comes from your pulpit. I was 15 years old at the time. When I got married in a Lutheran church, I found that loving God. Now I want to share that with everyone because this is where it's at. It's not in the Lutheran church. It's in the Church of God, Church of Christ. We're all a part of it. That document says a lot. So if you have a frame that will fit the thing, put it in a prominent place where you can see it, where others can see it. It's like the Bible. Unless you read it, unless it's presented to others, it's never going to grow. It's like a seed that gets unwatered. We have a lot to do. We have a lot of people to contact. There are a lot of Johns out there. There are a lot of Rons out there. There are a lot of Luds. You know, you name it. They're out there working God's mission. We have to, as Christian natives, do likewise. Not to our own people, but also to the Rons and the Johns and whoever, you know. It's got to be a wholesale battle. It's got to be something that we all work at.
Well, in my work, when I'm out visiting tribal communities, there are people that question the apology. And I feel it's, you know, they have a lot of basis for questioning it. My personal feelings, the apology means a lot to me, but it will mean a whole lot more when it goes down into the congregation. The bishops have made a statement, and the bishops are in a position where they can make a difference in the local congregation, but I haven't really seen that happening yet. And we need the support of all of those congregations, the people that will stand beside the Native American when we have these problems being attacked through the courts, being attacked by the coalitions of governors, of coalitions of the attorney generals, coalitions of county commissioners, all the anti-Indian organizations that are sprouting up. We have Treaty Bureau in Washington State that is going to financially support any person that will run for an office that will support that, who stand for the anti-Indian thinking. We need a lot of help fight this, because historically this has been going on ever since the white man has come here. Things have been just taken away from us. We still have some land and we still have some resources, and there are people that want that.
And until the churches really stand behind us and really support us, there will be a time when we won't have any land left, we won't have any resources. We have very little left. And so for this apology to mean something to me, in my heart, I want to see those bishops talking to the whoever it takes to make those mandates that the church at the grassroots level, where they have their social concerns committees that are concerned about Nicaragua, they're concerned about these other countries far off. But you don't see the social concerns committee that's concerned about Native Americans. That's when that paper will mean something to me. And that's when it will mean something to a lot of other Native Americans. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, and I appreciate the heart and the love that went into that. But there's a whole lot more work that needs to be done for it to really take effect.
You will need to keep reminding us of what we've done. I have a feeling, as I sit and listen this morning, and I don't know quite how to describe it, I feel like I'm kind of in a whirlwind as I sense and feel the reaction of what is a document on the part of many of you and your people, which I think many of us who are white in the church have not begun to comprehend. I think oftentimes, I don't know how the bishops felt as they signed that document. I'm sure they did. I know that they must have done it with a great deal of care and prayer and thought and argument, as John has said, before they finally came to a consensus. But I have a suspicion that maybe even they didn't know quite what they were signing. And the thought that went through my mind is sometimes when we say or do things without knowing the full implications of what that might be, and as the winds begin to swirl around us from the effect of what we have done, it may be that we begin to think, my God, what have we done? What have we done? Because as I sit and sense, that's the feeling I get from the reaction that I've heard has come from many Indian people. Not only the positive feelings, but the reality too. And that's what I mean, I guess, when I say, I think you will have to help remind us of what we have said and done. Because without that reminder, it is very easy to, not out of a sense of duplicity, that is, not out of a sense that what we have done and said or signed was not meant, but perhaps more out of a sense of the pressure of so many things, that what we do in one moment becomes lost in the backwater of the pressure from so many other things. And don't have to speak about the pressure that everyone feels from so many things. I certainly been reminded, and it's true, that I sit here representing a quote structure of the church. And there are so many pressures that come, and it's easy to do one thing today and get involved in others tomorrow. And that's why we will need that reminder. I appreciate being here today, because as much as I've known about the document and even read it more than once, sit here today and to begin to feel the power of what that document has unleashed and has the potential for unleashing is to me another reality about that that I have not sensed until this morning. And I agree with you, Marilyn. I think that if that's true for me, then I know it's true 100-fold for the people in the parishes and for the pastors in our church and for many others who perhaps at best have only heard of this without being at all aware of the ramifications of what that's that holds.
I'm hopeful for the movement that I'm sensing that is happening around the country as different groups are becoming aware of this document and trying to find some ways in which they can continue offering up a similar kind of challenge in their own local communities. And I think we all need to be really prayerful for the kinds of energies that need to happen so that those things can kind of break through and come to birth. I received a phone call from a woman from the Rosebud Reservation a couple weeks ago, and she was in the midst of telling me all kinds of other things that were going on. She was telling me about the meeting that she had attended about a month ago, which for those of you that might not be aware, South Dakota is celebrating a year of reconciliation. And the idea of how some of that is happening right now is government people, tribal people, people that have been sought out for whatever expertise it is that they think is welcomed at the table or appropriate at this discussion table, have been coming together in these various meetings. And at the meeting that this young woman had attended, she said some of the church people wanted to start their own letter of apology. And it was really interesting because some of the native people hadn't heard, you know, about, you know, what had happened out here in the Northwest and some of the challenges. So it's kind of like starting literally from scratch with their reactions and how you get started with something like this. And she started to tell me, not knowing that John was a really good friend of mine, and, you know, and she's a distant relative of mine, some of the anxiety that was coming up, you know, for her and some of the other people that were sitting at that table that day. And she said, you know, I think it's just appalling that they want to offer us an apology. And so I wanted to kind of feel her out and work with some of the anger and the rage that she was feeling, and have her go through listing some of the processes that she, you know, was beginning to address and some of the concerns. And she said, it seems so remote, again, that we come up with another document of words. You know, she said, when I think that, she said, maybe it's a beginning and I'm willing to go along with that. But she said, it still doesn't change the attitudes that we get when we go in stores and go shopping and people follow us around because they think we're gonna rip them off. And it doesn't change anything with how Rosebud is dealing with, and it fluctuates, I suppose, from 70 to 90% unemployment and little economic opportunities because of the land base and all kinds of other issues. And so there we see again another pocket of hope and still yet another pocket of challenge. And you know, and just coming back from Wisconsin and standing on the boat docks with other church folks, you know, I still see all the pain and the you know, the incredible work that needs to still await us as we build those relationships, you know. And I think the apology has been a wonderful place to begin, but I'm still challenged by all those other things that still need to happen. And, you know, Marilyn and I started to have this conversation on the hallway about this. And so, you know, I, as a person, you know, as a called and ordained person in the ELCA, I feel probably that struggle even more, you know, about how we involve those people in the congregations, how we involve them to leave and live in their heart, to think, you know, that we are all together in this, and that there are incredible barriers of things that we still have to deal with.